Hello and welcome to episode 10 of series 2 of the Agents Folk podcast. My name is Tim Cox and I am an educational psychologist working in the northeast of England. And I'm really happy today to have Dr. Gavin Morgan with me today, and we're going to be talking about change in education. So I'm going to leave it up to Gavin to introduce himself and talk a bit about how we've come to have this conversation. Thank you, Gavin.
Yeah, good afternoon, Tim. Thank you for inviting me. I was thinking this afternoon how I ended up chatting to you, and I mean pragmatically it was the conversation that we had at the DCP conference back in March. But it's been a long time coming, because I've seen you present things at trainee conferences and the main DCP conference, and I thought, aha, this guy's interesting. This guy's got something valuable to share and to say, and I want to talk to you. So we've had lots of conversations now over recent weeks. That's it essentially. I think there's a meeting of minds here, I think you've got some interesting things to say, and I'm hoping we can explore those this afternoon.
Absolutely. So for the listeners' benefit, could you just tell the audience what your day-to-day looks like and what kind of projects you're involved with at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk through what I do now, and if you like, I've got a bit of a journey narrative to how I ended up here, and also the context is, Tim, I've just turned 50, and I think it's a very reflective age. You get to 50, think, wow, how did I get here? How long have I got left? What do I want to achieve? And that's led to me doing a lot of kind of reflection, really, about me, about what I've done. And I think people always assume that life is kind of linear, but it's not. I mean, there's decisions and things that happen that you end up doing what you're doing. And it is often by accident. It's often not planned out. So I'm mainly working at University College London on the trainee educational psychology doctorate. I also work on the CPD doctorate in educational psychology at University College London. Let me take you back to how I ended up there. I've always been fascinated by education. From a young child, really, and I often thought, I enjoy school. School's good. School's fun. I'm getting a lot from school, and I found lessons quite interesting. But I was always, I've always been interested in people. I've always been interested in interaction, and even from a young age, I was thinking, okay, I'm finding this easy. I'm enjoying this. Kid next to me is struggling. Why is that? Why isn't the kid next to me finding this easy? So this sounds very grand, but from an early age, I was often questioning why I found education quite straightforward and why the kid next to me was struggling. So, growing up and, getting into kind of teenage years, I became interested in kind of psychology. And I was, as I said, always interested in people, always had a sense of kind of social justice as well, really. And knowing that I wanted to make things better. You're 14, 15, 16, thinking, okay, what does the future hold for me? So I had this interest in education. I had this interest in kind of psychology. And there's me thinking, I wonder if there's a job where you can mix education and psychology. And there I was, sort of 16, and I discovered the wonderful, exciting world of educational psychology. So I'm one of these unusual people that from a relatively early age, I'm talking 16 really, knew that I wanted to be an educational psychologist. I knew that I didn't want to be a teacher, but I knew that I wanted to work in education, and I was fascinated by people. So to me, it's kind of the perfect career move, the perfect career trajectory for me. So I kind of knew from then that's kind of what I wanted to do. I mean, as I said, I'm 50. So when I, we're talking 30 years ago now, the 25, 30 years ago, the career route was you had to be a teacher.
Okay.
So I took the old traditional route, straightforward psychology degree, PGCE. Then I taught for 4 years. And I deliberately, I mean, again, we're talking sort of mid-90s. Around then, as there are now, there were lots of cuts to education, but I saw it as an opportunity. So you would often see 1 year temporary teacher contracts offered. And I thought, okay, I could take it easy. I could just work in a nice, quiet village school for, you know, 2 or 3 years and then get on to a training course. But I deliberately chose these temporary contracts because I thought, I want to know what schools are like. I want to get into a school. I want to, you know, get into the skin of school. So I deliberately chose short-term contracts that enabled me to get quite a wide range of teaching experience before moving on to the master's, as it was then. So then we're talking, you know, late 90s when I trained down in Bristol. Absolutely loved it. Really enjoyed it from day one. But I remember being a teacher. I started my EP training as a teacher. And I was thinking like a teacher. I wasn't necessarily thinking like a psychologist. And again, looking back and thinking about things, I'd become a teacher. And I'd lost my psychology in a way. It was kind of beaten out of me because teaching is demanding. And you know, you have to conform to a certain way of thinking when you're a teacher. So I was very much a teacher. And I remember it wasn't until midway through my year, my master's year, kind of the veils lifted from my eyes, and I kind of thought, I get it. I see it. I can see what they were trying to teach us. And I literally midway through the course, I began to see things as a psychologist. Rather than a teacher. And I know we've had some interesting conversations because I think you took a different route.
Yeah, I mean, I took a slightly different route in terms of training as a historian. That's a loose term for doing an undergrad history degree. But similarly, I was interested in people.
Yeah.
Came from a family of vicars and teachers. Wow. And didn't want to go down the clerical route.
Yeah.
Those are sort of my reference points. So I went and did history. I was good at that at school. And then went and pragmatically took a job in a school as a pastoral head of year, which meant I had a lot of FaceTime with people that I didn't have any FaceTime with at my own school. We were in a set system. I was usually middle to upper sets, and it was a real wake-up call in lots of ways in terms of helping to understand that my idea about the world just being it'll get better regardless of what you do and progress being linear, that was very much stopped in its tracks. This was about 2008, so just 2009, sorry, into the financial crash. It was a real stark wake-up call that, number one, not everybody was like me at secondary school. Number two, I didn't really know what to do other than listen, which I eventually got around to, having exhausted all other avenues. And then, like you, kind of thought, well, this is the first real big challenge in my life, in particularly in a career-wise, and then wanted to go and get lots of different experiences of different schools to try and understand the nature of the beast, like you would as a historian going and talking to, going to different sources to find it, and happened upon an educational psychologist whilst I was working in a pupil referral unit in South Wales called Nicola Canalo, who I've had on the podcast, who I was like, oh, they're thinking in a really, really interesting way about this. And I'd quite like to learn about that. But she was my first, she set me off on that trajectory about psychology before I thought psychology is something that people who don't want to take hard academic subjects take. Number one, and number two, it's a bit of a girly subject.
Okay, so
I'd kind of gone into all the cliches about psychology,
yeah,
and then found it in my mid-20s and thought, this is the thing that makes a lot of my life make sense. And if only I'd had that conversation before, then perhaps my life trajectory would have been, if not easier, I'd been prepared for the challenge.
I mean, you make a good point, but I mean, I'm always I mean, we'll talk about UCL in a moment and what happens there. But I'm always very impressed by people that have taken conversion degrees. You know, I did it in a very traditional way. I knew what I wanted to do, and I took various choices to enable me to do it. But I'm always impressed by people that have come to it a bit later and have also kind of realized that's what they want to do. They thought they were going to do history. They thought they'd be a history teacher or lecturer or whatever. And you end up thinking, no, actually, 180 degree turn. I want to actually become a psychologist. And those people really impress me. The people that have done conversion degrees and what have you, to me, they're always mightily impressive, because it's harder. It's more difficult to do it that way. So I'm always, you know, really, really, really impressed by people that have done conversion courses.
I mean, I think, you know, I've worked and trained with a lot of people who've done the traditional route, and that seems hard enough in itself to have that goal for so long and to continue to it. And I guess you bring different things, and perhaps through that history lens I brought a bit of a panoramic view those understanding of the power of story and how that influences culture and all. So I was thinking, I guess, in quite a Bronte for Brenner sort of way.
Nice.
And I just remember when I did my master's at Bristol, it was, you know, road to Damascus, sort of, like you say, scales off the eyes. Uh-huh. Things start to, okay. So there's a science to this.
Yeah.
Not just chaos and making the best.
Yeah.
And then I was able to go and apply that in similar roles in Bristol that I had done, and found that I had a very different experience having something to come back to and thinking about it more in a sciencey way in terms of hypothesis and assumption and how the story and theory interlink and all of those sort of things. And I guess through that and then doing training, I had a very similar experience, I guess, in year one, where I was thinking, what does a psychologist actually do? It's so hard to say what it is. And then I guess it came to me again in another sort of kind of light bulb moment of, you know, it's about, it's fundamentally about hope in education and positive change.
Absolutely.
And then I guess I've just gone with that and remember that ever since, and been preaching about it to anybody who will listen.
Absolutely, and rightfully so. I just finished, you know, my kind of journey as to how I ended up what I'm doing, but as I said, I absolutely loved my EP training, and I had many conversations with John Franey, who was deputy course director at the time down in Bristol, and you know, we got on really well, and I kind of said, John, tell me about, you know, your job, what you do, because at the time he was a senior EP in Bristol, and he was also co-running the course at Bristol, and I was kind of thinking, I want to do that. So at the time I kind of set myself a sort of a 10-year career goal. It's the only time I've kind of really tried to map out a career trajectory for myself. I thought, right, within 10 years I want to be a senior EP. I want to be a tutor on a training course. And it happened. I managed that within 9 years. So 2006, I was appointed a senior EP in Cambridgeshire. And 2008, 2009, fortunate enough to see a vacancy arise at UCL. I thought, aha, here's my chance, my way in. Mm-hmm. And joined the tutor team at UCL. About 15 years ago almost now, and loved every minute of it. I mean, I've always enjoyed working with trainees. I love my training years, I keep saying. I took every opportunity I could before I became a senior to supervise trainees, and I thought, I want to do this. I find it really inspirational working with trainees for many reasons. I mean, trainees are enthusiastic, they're energetic, they want to do well, they're curious, they ask all the right questions, sometimes the awkward questions. You know, why did you do that? Why did you say that? Why did you do that test? Why did you sit at the back of that classroom and observe? And you're kind of thinking, why do I do those things? And again, it's linking in with what I'm saying about that kind of reflection. And that, you know, trainees are really great at that, asking those kind of questions. why do you do that? Why did you say that? Why did you ask that parent that question? And you're kind of thinking, yeah, why do I do it that way? So I've always been really interested in this notion of kind of, you know, reflective practice and thinking about why I do things, thinking about how things could be better, mm-hmm. how things could be different. And again, working with trainees, that's an everyday occurrence. And I don't think you necessarily get that as you know, the job in kind of EP necessarily, but and that's why I've always been really keen to maintain my working with trainees and again why I enjoy being part of the UCL team so much.
Yeah, I mean, I guess something reflecting back on something that you said earlier about becoming hardened as a teacher, even though that your initial goal was to be an EP, I can really relate to that, being almost 2 years into the job now, of feeling being hardened within a system of you start to look for things or see things in a way which is perhaps less curious and perhaps more pragmatic, and you're thinking about numbers and hours and support systems and all of those sort of things, and you can feel it, I guess that curiosity and energy that trainees bring, and even people who are just interested in psychology and educational psychology becomes a judge against you. I was that, so I need to bring that back into being. I guess that's, you know, part of the reason I wanted to set up a mechanism such as this podcast to keep myself engaged in those conversations, even though they can be a judge at times to think, oh, where have I gone? And, you know, things aren't linear. And you do, you know,
absolutely.
I guess Jung talked about circumambulation, about, you know, walking around who you'll become eventually. So it's really good to be, you know, talking to you and, you know, having the EP community generally at DCP conference and Twitter, who are able to reflect things back and to be positive about things. So we've kind of come together to talk about, I guess, change management and education. I guess it's something that's really, really live in the profession generally, and at all the sort of micro, macro, meso system levels. And it's a hot topic that's been discussed on this podcast before. So what is your kind of take about education and the need or the experience of change? That's a huge question.
It is huge, but it's very relevant. And as I said, I became a senior in 2006 in Cambridgeshire, and I'm not sure I together found that a positive experience. And this enabled me to begin questioning a few things. In parallel to that, I'd finished my master's and I immediately enrolled on the CPD educational psychology doctorate, which was in place then at Bristol. So I was undertaking a doctorate when I became a senior EP. Okay. And that kind of opened up ways of thinking. And I'm going to get to talk about change in a moment, but it's all relevant. So I was coming to the end of my doctorate, and I was thinking about systems. I was thinking about the system, this huge county shire system that I'd almost naively walked into as a senior EP. And you're idealistic, and certainly when you start a new role and a new post and a senior job, you think, right, brilliant, I'm going to change things. I'm going to change everything. And straight away, I found that very difficult. I found it really difficult to try and change things, to try and make things better. There were many great things, many lovely people, fantastic people in Cambridgeshire, but there were things there that I was thinking, that needs to change. I want to do that differently. And I found that quite difficult to do. So at the same time, I was thinking, I've got a doctoral thesis I need to do as well. So I was wondering, is there any scope of trying to think about change management in organisations alongside my doctorate, alongside my senior role at the time? I wasn't yet at UCL. That led me to think about, okay, maybe I can apply some kind of solution-focused approaches here. I've been very inspired by solution-focused interventions when I was a trainee, and it became a kind of a hallmark, really, of the early days of my practice. And I again, I like those naive questions that, that I used to ask teachers, you know, when I was a young, enthusiastic EP. You know, teachers would come to consultations with me, you know, reams of paperwork about how challenging a child was, how difficult the situation is, you know, reams of paper about all the negative things that have happened. I'd say, oh, great, okay, thank you for that. And then I'd rather impertinently come back and say, so, you know, tell me when he's good. Tell me when he's less bad. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, I thought you wanted to know about how difficult things are. But yeah, I'm being quite facetious. I mean, I didn't do it solely like that. Of course, you empathize and you listen. But I did throw that question in quite early on in the conversation, and it often threw them. But it often, ultimately, it did lead to those kind of light bulb moments in the teacher thinking, okay, maybe there are some times when things are okay or less bad or, you know, or good. Mm. And, you know, straight away then I'm preaching to converted here, but straight away you've got the beginnings of interventions. But that kind of question's always excited me, really, you know, just tipping things on its head and trying to get people thinking a little bit differently about why they do stuff, why people do stuff. Again, it's that question that trainees always ask that I like so much. So there's me, this solution-focused teacher, coming up against impossible systems, thinking, okay, is there some way that I can begin to unlock this at the same time as trying to get a doctoral thesis? So I've always been inspired by interventions such as PATH, Planning Alternative Tomorrows with Hope. And I dabbled a little bit in trying to apply those principles to schools, to classes, to teachers, to systems. Primarily, you know, as you know, it's used for individuals and, you know, kids struggling, kids facing exclusion. But I was thinking, is there some way that I can apply those principles to people, to groups of people? And that ultimately became my doctoral thesis. So, yeah, what I did, I worked with schools, I worked with educational psychology departments, student assessment teams, basically systems that were struggling, systems that knew they were struggling, systems, you know, people in those systems wanting things to be better. So they'd come to that point, we can't carry on like this. We know things have to change. And I had various conversations with SENCOs and heads and line managers, and word got out that, oh, Gavin's interested in this. So I went on a bit of a blitz around the country, really, not just in Cambridgeshire, but you know, trying to do PATH with organizations. And that ultimately became my doctoral thesis and a paper that was published about 5 years or so ago, Educational Psychology in Practice. So that's kind of what I did, and yeah, that's what led me to want to apply those principles, because I myself was frustrated with systemic change, knowing that things could be different, could be better. And yeah, I found some fascinating findings really from that. I don't know if you want to ask me anything about that before we move on to those.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you're talking there, I guess what it made me think about, and something that's come up again and again in my practice, particularly since I've qualified and it's probably been slightly less curious and brave about the things that I've done, is that often it's thinking about the system can be a difficult thing to contend with, particularly when you don't know what the vision of that system is. And I guess clarifying something like that through PATH can be really helpful to think about, okay, how can I be just helpful and not somebody who's an idealist who's trying to engage a system at a level that might be helpful, but only if it's plugged into something that's already existing in the system. And it makes me think of the concept in activity theory, when they talk about within any system you've got internalizers who want to keep a status quo for a reason, and externalize as you see what the contradiction is in that system and want to make a change. And I guess sometimes we're kind of posed as the externalizer, or we see ourselves as the externalizer, but we've got to get what the status quo is and why that's important, and how we can work together to bring, you know, yeah. there'll be objectives to change, but what the actual outcome of those changes are, we can help to tailor that, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I remember having, I saw my role in those paths as very much a facilitator, mm-hmm. really, almost, you know, passive facilitator, because I remember having a conversation with a manager from a team that was struggling, and you know, she was saying to me, I had a phone call with her, she said, oh, it's really tough, it's really bad. I was like, stop, I don't want to know anything. Mm-hmm. She goes, oh, don't you want to know how bad things are? I was like, no, you know, it doesn't matter at the moment for me to hear that. Let me come and see you next week. Let me come and see your team next week. We'll just do something together. I don't necessarily need to know how bad things are. And again, she was quite surprised by that. So, my role in those is just facilitator, just asking those curious questions, and getting them to name things, getting them to come up with the narrative. I was accompanied by a guy who was doing graphicing, so we had this graphic developing behind me. It was really mm-hmm. good stuff, and all I did was ensured that everybody's voice was heard, including those people that you're saying that are status quoers that are a bit more kind of cynical. But there's various things that you can do. I mean, I'm kind of maybe undermining my own role by saying I'm a passive facilitator, but there's things that you do as a psychologist during those conversations, during those sessions, that encourage those status quoers, those resistors to change, to actually get on board. And that kind of did happen. But again, it's very much me giving them the space to talk and to explore issues that are important to them. And I think the most powerful thing in PATH is kind of getting that vision. So you begin with the end point. So again, it's not, you know, you don't have that kind of negative talk. You begin with a positive talk. Where do we want to be? What is our vision for our team? And just listing these kind of idealistic words and getting them to imagine it. And I think that is so powerful that, you know, traveling towards a vision is really quite powerful. And again, that's what I was trying to do in those sessions, getting teams to see a future, see how things could be better. So just getting them to talk about it and getting them to kind of in that frame of mind, and again that can help. It becomes contagious, really, when you're working with groups of people. I found it really powerful. And again, the very first thing I do, and you know, without necessarily going through the stages of PATH, but you know, one of the early things is literally to imagine it's 12 months in the future. So I get people to imagine, what's today's date? It's 16th of June. I get people to imagine it's 16th of June, 2023. Tell me all the wonderful things that you've done.
Yeah.
What have you achieved? What is different? How does it look? How does it feel? You know, personal things. Yes, somebody got married or had a baby or whatever. But all the wonderful things that you've done as a team. Oh, yeah. Do you remember in September when we changed this? Or December when we had that Christmas party and that was really good. Everyone came together and were happy. And in March, we came together and we changed that policy. So you get, again, it sounds quite idealistic. You get people to think about how things might be different and better. So that's 12 months in the future. Then you pare it down to 6 months. Right, it's now December 22. What have you achieved? But you get people to talk in the past tense, and that's really quite powerful. Again, we did this, we achieved that, we got this done in December. And then, you know, it's 3 months. Right, so by September, what will you have done? Okay, by September, in September, we did this. In August, this happened. And before you know it, you've got that energy, that momentum. Okay, so imagine it's 1 month. It's the 16th of July. We're sketching out where you're going to be in June 23, December, where will you be by July? What has changed? What have you put in place? Okay. And before you know it, right, what will you have done by the end of this week? What will you have done by today, end of the day? What will you have done by the time I've left you this morning? So it's that narrative that is so powerful, I think.
Yeah, I think it's pretty powerful. And I think the reason that it's powerful is that, well, I guess from my analysis of what's going on there, is by that goal setting, you're immediately tapping in from this vision, which is about, I guess, a sort of transcendent sense of where the system could go and what it's for, to an idea where you're thinking about how your agency as a team, how your pathway thinking as a team can go towards that. and how it would be useful to feed back progress to each other.
Yeah.
On that, and then you've got that sense of momentum coming out of it. And it's something that, you know, I love that, because it's, you know, for me, I can kind of analyze what's going on in terms of hope theory and all of those sort of things. But after our conversation at the DCP conference about using PATH systemically, it's always something that I thought that you could do, but I've had an increase in my patch within my local authority. So with all my new Senkos and head teachers, I've been sitting down and doing a PATH from that idea that you had about, you know, what, you know, what's the vision for the school? How can I understand that? And what can we be doing? And I've split it into the three terms. So that we can have a sense of really evaluating what the power of education and EP work working together on that. But anyway, before I go too much into my own practice, so what were the findings that you found from?
Yeah, so again, as I said, I was fortunate enough to maybe do six or seven of these, and I thought, maybe I've got a thesis here.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then I analyzed. Well, what I then did was having done these, I then went back to the main protagonists from each of these organizations. I said, can we have a quick chat? I had semi-structured interviews with all the managers that were part of those teams at the time that I was doing those interventions, and yeah, thematic analysis and what have you. And I found some really, really fascinating conclusions, really, and some interesting things that kind of link into kind of systems and organizations. But a really powerful quote that kind of emerged from it was, you can't hire knowledge, you must grow it. And that's kind of stayed with me. And this is when I kind of get critical of, you know, management consultants and things and parachuting these people in to kind of change systems. It won't work. If you try this came out of all the interviews that I did. If you try and impose change upon a team, upon people, or upon anybody, the first reaction is the resistance.
Yeah.
So somebody come in and say, right, what you're doing here is no good. You need to change A, B, and C, and that will happen. And people say, hang on, who are you coming in and telling me what to do? That will never work. Management consultants just being, as I said, you know, dropping in and trying to change a failing system. It's not gonna work. It's not going to happen. The change can only come from the people that are doing the job. And that was something quite powerful. My overall thesis, really, I suppose, is that what is the most powerful thing in organizations is cultural knowledge, tacit cultural knowledge, knowing what we do around here. And that's how you affect change, by working with that tacit cultural knowledge. You need that knowledge, which is why, and I argued this in my thesis, because again, I was going through this at the time, that a senior EP is so vitally important, because they're kind of caught between the two. Distant managers, principal EPs to some extent, but certainly the managers of principal EPs, they don't know. They don't know what an EP does on a day-to-day basis. A senior EP will, and certainly the people in the front line, they know what works, they know what doesn't work within their own system, within their own team. A distant manager won't. A distant manager might try and impose change, but it will lead to resistance. So in order for change to be effective, you need to tease out that tacit cultural knowledge, draw that out, talk to the people that are doing on the front line, that are doing the job. They know what works. They know what doesn't work. They know what needs to change. That was my overall kind of thesis, really. You know, that was my idea, that this is where the energy is. It's people doing the job. They know how change can work. But if you impose change on teams and on people, their reaction will be to dig their heels in.
I mean, I think that's definitely something that's come up in the podcast before and comes up repeatedly, is that sometimes we have an idea about what should change and why it should change, and we can become quite hardwired in that sense, but imposing it on other people, is a different thing. And I guess that can be, we're living in an age where, social justice issues can be quite polarizing, and there's very definite ways from each side to manage that. And I guess the thesis that I've come to from trying to manage that and thinking about that and studying that is that it's the dialogue between the two sides, which actually is the change catalyst. And the change is more incremental than either side would envision, but eventually over time, you get towards that vision, and that is always going to be meaningful rather than saying, this is the new initiative. This is what we need to do.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the, I think particularly the last decade, perhaps, and probably before that, and I wasn't working in education before 2009, there does seem to have been a politicization of what teachers should be doing or could be doing, same with social workers, same with the education system in general. And that doesn't necessarily, it is that distance from politicians that say, policymakers, about how that actually works on the ground. And I guess as EPs or senior EPs or trainees, we're always going to be caught between that and trying to make things grow towards a certain thing, and I guess we can advocate for certain points of view and rights and all of those sort of things. So lots of what you've said from your finding really kind of rings true into my experiences and ideas about change. And I guess one big change that we've all experienced over the last 2-3 years is the change that is being imposed by the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I guess the systems and the people within those systems moved quite quickly during that pandemic to make a new education system. But I guess the ramifications, the echoes of that are just starting to be felt.
Yeah.
So what's kind of your view on when change is imposed by something external which we can't control but we have to apply to? What's your view on that?
Okay, lots of points you've picked up on there. I mean, we can talk about the pandemic separately in a moment. There's things we can reflect on that I've been doing there as well. I mean, I think it's helpful to kind of view organizations almost as living creatures, living systems, and within that they will live, they will evolve, and they may die. But there's things that you can do to kind of support the longevity of systems. And again, I suppose the most powerful thing to me is that the most valuable thing in any organization, any system, is the people, is the people within it. And so therefore people need nurturing, people need relationships, people need to have that recognition that what they're doing is valuable and important. And I think, again, when change is imposed, that can be difficult. So ideally what you want is there to be a meeting of kind of bottom up change. And again, this is what was coming up from my paths, really, that small groups of systems knew they needed to change. So there was an energy. The change was coming from the bottom up, and ideally you want that to meet with kind of top down change. That is the kind of the perfect model, I think, really. And I think also within complex organizations, when one part of the system moves, when one part of the system changes, it's obvious that change is needed elsewhere. And again, that can be difficult. Again, like in a complex local authority, for example, the EPS has changed. Oh, so that means there's implications then for the student assessment team or whatever. So that was something else that became apparent, that change needs to happen elsewhere. So you need that energy within any organization for that to happen. And what's also important is it, again, this came out of the interviews, that it can't be a one-off, that you need to have regular points in the road, really, to kind of So how are we doing? So, you know, in every organization, school or service, they all had photocopies of my paths all pinned up, and managers would often refer to them and point at them. And they found that to be quite powerful.
Yeah.
So again, the vision was there, literally. So there was reminders about what they were working towards. And I think you need that. And it's literally physically a vision there then. So, you know, me just going in, saying, right, there you go, there's your path, walking away. You need that energy to be maintained. So we've all in all those interventions, I kept going back. So how are things? You know, do we need to look at things again? What isn't working? What is working? Great, it's working, you know, all the stuff that we do more of it. So I think you do need that kind of idea of review, maintenance, and energy. But above all else, it's the vision, and it's getting the narrative across the team. And again, that can become contagious, because one team will think, oh, they're doing something differently in the EPS, and it's, you know, this seems to be working. What can we do differently? So that contagion again, it relates back to the narrative. It relates back to the vision. Above all else, it's the kind of the meeting of that top down and bottom up change that is needed, I think.
I mean, something just kind of sprang to the front of my mind as you were talking there, about particularly about doing this kind of work with EPSs and education psychologists as well, is that sometimes we can see ourselves on the kind of borders of different systems, but yeah, it's important that we know what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's just we're part of systems.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So we've got to be part of those conversations. Uh-huh. In order that we don't just have our status quo, this is the way we do it,
yeah,
and whether it fits with you or not. And I think that seemed to be an important point from what you were just kind of saying there.
I mean, you touched on the pandemic, which is a huge issue, and that's a huge, significant change that nobody saw coming, and has had significant ramifications and still is. I mean, I'm very concerned about the kind of the mental health of our kids, really. You know, being cut off from schools for so long, and again, not having that physical contact, I think has been really damaging. I mean, I wanted to talk about that if that's okay with you, because at the start of the pandemic, I was invited to join SPIB. Which is Scientific Pandemic Behavioral Insights Team.
Okay.
So you've got SAGE, which reports to the Cabinet and the Prime Minister, Patrick Vallance, and those people. And there's two subgroups. SPI-M, which is a modelling group, which is doing all the stats and all the numbers, all the mathematicians and stats guys looking at the figures and the R number. And then the parallel group is SPI-B, which is predominantly psychologists trying to look at, you know, societal change, behaviour management.
Mm-hmm.
And I got invited to join that right at the beginning of when schools closed. So talking March 2020.
Yeah.
I had a phone call from the BPS saying, you know, that they'd like an educational psychologist to join SPI-B. It's really good that somebody had that foresight to think, perhaps we need an educational psychologist on board here, because a lot of the psychologists there, they're from different traditions, really, yeah, shall we say, more concerned with numbers of people rather than thinking about the implications that this might have on people and certainly on children. So I was there. I saw my role there really as an advocate for children. And I began asking awkward questions because, you know, start of the pandemic, schools closed. Nobody had kind of given any thought as to how schools might reopen.
Yeah.
And I think the very first thing I said in the first SPI-B meeting I went to was like, you know, what is the plan to reopen schools? And they were like, oh, we just close them. I said, I know, but we need to think about how and when we're going to reopen them. So nobody had kind of thought about that. Do I have a bit of a plan? Maybe it's me naturally as a psychologist. I'm always thinking of the future. Mm-hmm. And I'm always thinking about how, you know, I'm always future focused. Right. Okay. So what is the problem here? How can we solve this problem? They were more concerned about ensuring that people obeyed rules. And
N nudging.
that the people were scared enough to comply with staying at home, you know, and they weren't necessarily thinking about the implications that it was going to have. And I was there thinking, this isn't good. So right from the word go. And then this links in with my other roles, really, in psychology and promoting psychology. But right from the word go, I was thinking about the mental health of our kids. And I was advocating for schools to reopen and getting a plan for schools to reopen. And I was very concerned about the mental health of children. I mean, we're talking, you know, March, April, so schools had only just closed, but I could see what was going to happen. And again, in the early meetings that I went to, I was thinking, look, you know, we've got attachment issues here for a lot of kids. For a lot of our children, school is the one stable factor in their lives. Their relationship with their teacher is vitally important. And we need to be mindful of this because suddenly they're cut off from that. For some kids, you know, being at home may not be the most stable place for them. And we were thrusting our kids back into homes, asking a lot of our parents, you know, to teach kids. You know, they're parents, they're not teachers. So I was very concerned about that. I was very concerned about the mental health implications that would face our children for not being able to see their friends, just play, the importance of play, not necessarily learning, but just being alongside their friends. I thought that was missing. So I kind of grasped every opportunity that came my way because I got invited to do quite a lot of media work. And I was kind of shouting this really from the rooftops. What about the mental health of our kids? We're going to have problems. And I think we're dealing with those now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see that in the work that you're doing, you know, 2 years on really from the first school closures, that we're still picking up the pieces of damaged kids from the pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, I remember having a conversation with a psychiatrist during lockdown, and we were talking about COVID recovery. I was working with a group called Citizens UK. We were talking with community organisers about how we could have a emotionally healthy response to that. And you know, he used the word, you know, tsunami of mental health difficulties following it, and the fact that, you know, schools and other systems, you know, they were kind of gambling on the fact that schools could meet, you know, the need. He was talking about kind of traffic light system of, you know, 8 and above out of 10, then it will be kind of clinically met need through the NHS, and then everything else needed to be met through systems like schools, churches, mosques, civil society.
Yeah.
But who's having that conversation? It's a big assumption to make.
Absolutely.
And it's really been interesting to hear you talk about such high level work that you're doing at a sort of governmental level, and the importance of having the vision of what we want for our children's development, rather than just that kind of safe, compliant society.
Exactly. Yeah.
And when does the safety and compliance actually become unsafe?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's fascinating to hear. And I'd say thank you for doing that.
Thanks, Tim. I mean, I was often a bit of a lone voice, really. I had very few allies within SPIBE. It's quite a big group. You know, there's any one time there was like 30 academics and psychologists. There was me, often a lone voice, because one of the things that I also was concerned about, and again, this got me into a bit of hot water, it got quite controversial, because I wasn't necessarily, I took my views to be there to give an alternative, really, because it's very easy, as we know, again, organisations for groupthink to go along with that predominant thinking. And, you know, sometimes we need a different perspective. So one of the controversial issues was the wearing of masks, face masks. And I argued that that we shouldn't be asking our kids to wear masks. And again, the view of Sage and Spybe, let's put our kids in face masks. And I argued against that. And again, I took media opportunities to try and say that I wasn't particularly happy with that. Yes, there's transmission issues, but above all else, there's communication, there's speech and language development. There's you know, kids with special needs, that need to be able to see the mouth of their peers or of teachers in order to speak. Again, I was concerned about the impact this would have on speech language development and the impact on children with hearing impairments, that, you know, that wearing masks is a literal physical barrier. And yeah, this got then picked up by quite a lot of the right-wing media. Mm-hmm. And there's me, you know, fairly lefty psychologist suddenly in this realm of right-wing media. I got invited onto GB News, which had just started about this time last year. Yeah. I think they thought, oh, there's an interesting, you know, libertarian psychologist here who's anti-mask. Let's get him on. And I was quoted in the Daily Mail quite a lot with alongside a lot of libertarian right-wing conservative MPs. And I was thinking, hang on a minute, what's going on here? Because my views were chiming with them in terms of the resistance that I think there should have been about children wearing face masks. So that was an interesting place to be, because suddenly it's like, oh, hang on a minute, I'm now being seen as this rogue psychologist, this rogue academic who's, you know, on libertarian right winger, but which isn't the case really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the mask issue is obviously controversial, and I guess the vision that you were drawing from in terms of that wasn't about liberties.
No,
it was about
absolutely
child development, absolutely. And you know, I'm sure GB News weren't that well read on.
No.
You know,
no, who I was,
language communications, and all those things, but it's. Sometimes, I guess, when you have such a strong vision for change, it can be co-opted as part of something that is going to push people away from it because it's about being one person or another. And I guess it's important when we're having that vision for change and or at least having a antithesis to the consensus about face masks, about, and that's based on evidence base and all of those sort of things and child development. Absolutely. that you know, sometimes we don't want to put ourselves in a particular camp in case we get put alongside this person or that.
Exactly. I mean, but I felt me and one of my roles in SpyB was to be contrary and was to give an opposite viewpoint and was to ask again those awkward questions that we keep coming back to. So that's the role that I kind of took when I was in SpyB. I mean, yeah, working with the media is fascinating anyway, because certainly the right wing press, they're very selective in what they say, and they might phone you up for an interview, but they very much cherry pick from their interview to suit their agenda. So that happened quite a lot, that I ended up being quite frustrated by what the newspapers were saying, because I'd speak to a journalist for half an hour and there'd be 20 words from that they would quote that would support their overall narrative. And like I said, you know, the Daily Mail lumping me in with all these right-wing Tories. The only newspaper that was different was The Observer. And they invited me to write an opinion piece. And that wasn't at all edited. It was just me writing 500 words. And that then led to a front page story. You know, it was
right.
Psychologist warns of mental health meltdown. You know, I'm paraphrasing. I can't remember what the headline was. But again, that was great, because there was educational psychology, you know, on the front page of a national newspaper, and they just gave me scope to say what I wanted to say, and then they wrote their own front page story based upon my opinion piece. So again, you know, I took the opportunity that I had in SpyB to promote educational psychology, to make sure that educational psychology was out there. The easy option would have been to turn down media, TV, press interviews, but apart from GB News, virtually everything that came my way, I took. Because there was an opportunity here for me to talk about the impact of educational psychology and, again, the change that we can bring to society. And that's kind of what I wanted to achieve, in my moment in the spotlight, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think it's good to hear that there was that level of interest. And I guess perhaps what education psychology can promote is that sort of evidence-based approach and that vision for good enough child development, which are pretty coherent and the solid ground. Even if you might get lumped in with other things, you can say, well, this is the reason why. And that's not necessarily, that can be used as political football, but actually, you know, we need to couch our political conversations in psychology of actually what is good development. And, you know, I think it's one of those, although I think we probably experience a lot of resistance to changes that we suggest, what we're going towards, I would hope, is inherently hopeful and evidence-based and warranted. And those things, I think we can and should have confidence in doing. And it's good to hear that you took those opportunities that were afforded to you to have those conversations to discuss what I guess a lot of us were hoping somebody would say.
No, yeah, absolutely. And again, it comes back to, you know, what we've been reflecting on this afternoon, but it is that vision. And it is sharing that vision. And we do it on a small level when we're talking with teachers in consultations. We try and engender that vision within in them to see how things could be better with the children that, you know, they're concerned about. But it's all, to me, it all comes back to that kind of narrative, to that kind of seeing a different preferred future, even if it's on a small level with one consultation with a teacher, up to the kind of work I was doing with Spy B during the pandemic, ultimately for the government. And there's me trying to have a different vision really about the mental health of kids. But within that, there is that commonality of narrative and a vision. And again, that's been everything that has kind of, you know, shaped my career really. Again, as I was saying about me being 50 and reflecting on where I am and what I want to achieve and what I've done, I think it does come back to that kind of, yeah, shared vision. It is so vitally important.
Absolutely. And for me, you only get that by asking the people who are working day to day or living the day to day experience of schooling or education. And that for me is why hope is so important, because it allows for the development of a shared vision and a resetting of perhaps what school can be about for our young people.
Quite.
And the families that use them.
Exactly. Again, which is why I think what you're doing and the work that you're doing and your podcasts, you know, why they're so vital, really. Again, it's that narrative. And I love the name Agents of Hope. I mean, that's what we are. And it is about hope. You know, no matter how entrenched, how difficult a situation might be, you know, we always have to have that vision, that hope of seeing that things can be different.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I was just thinking about when you were talking before was you talked about when you're initially doing your research about being a facilitator of a path, and then you've become quite a big voice for change on a national level. Do you think it was context that changed that? Was it the role that you're doing? What changed your kind of thing from being a facilitator of something that might bring about change to an advocate for specific change?
Wow. That's a really good question. I think it's evidence. It's seeing the difference that you can make. And I think it's having the confidence to share that. I think that's what it comes down to, Tim, really, if I'm thinking about it. It's having feedback. It's seeing that you can achieve, that you can make a difference as a psychologist. You can bring about positive change. You can take people with you. I think that's what it is. It's that momentum. It's that confidence. Mm-hmm. Again, it's that narrative. It's a really good question. But I think that's what it comes down to. It's knowing that this works. It's knowing that this can really make a difference to schools, to teachers, to organizations. And then it just kind of balloons from that. But I think it's having the confidence in educational psychology. I mean, I'm a huge advocate for our profession. I think, you know, I think we can, I believe, and I always have believed, we can change the world, if only step by step, but it does become incremental. And what we're doing at every successful consultation that we have, we're kind of building that sense of confidence. And again, yeah, I think, you know, as I said, reflecting on being the age I am, that's kind of why I'm doing what I'm doing. It's because it's positive. It's because I can see that things are happening. I can see, you know, on a small level, I can see that I'm making a difference for trainees down at UCL. I'm having an impact on them. You know, it comes from that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it kind of, yeah, it just feels like you've had so many experiences of facilitating processes which would bring about change, and observing those and understanding those, whether that be as a senior educational psychologist or a researcher or somebody who's working on doctorates, which are all about those sort of positive change,
yeah.
Is that you get through, I guess, by being present with what's happening in those experiences, is that you start to understand what are the key components, and that thing that, you know, I can't remember the exact quote you said about you have to be able to grow knowledge.
You can't hide knowledge. You must grow it.
Yeah. And I think there's that is, I think that's really, really key, is that we're constantly in this sort of cycle of developing those knowledges, but by having a vision, we can sort of not dictate, but kind of choose where we see our victories. Rather than having to be the expert who is hired knowledge, but we're just in these conversations all the time. We're able to see what changes that we are making and thinking about how we feed that back to grow that momentum. And I think that's been a golden thread throughout this conversation, and it seems throughout your career, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's what we do. I mean, you know, you ask an educational psychologist or me, you know, what you do in a school. Like, I just talk to people, and that's all you do. You just go and talk to a teacher. Well, yeah, that's what it comes down to. But within that conversation, there's so much going on. But it does come back to that vision and trying to get the people that you're working with, whoever they are, whether it be a trainee psychologist, a stressed out Senko, or somebody within the government, you're trying to get them to see things different. And that's what we do so well as psychologists. It's our skills in those consultations, in you know, those all we're having is conversation, but within that, there's so much going on. And it is trying to get them to see a better, hopeful future, and that's what I do.
And I think that has to be, and it seems to be, and it certainly is for me, a very meaningful vocation, to continue to do that and use psychological tools that are available to us and orient them in those directions. That seems to be absolutely key and vital for the future of what we do and the development of the young people that we work with. Now, I'm aware that I've taken a bit of your time, and we've had a wide ranging conversation from kind of your narrative of how you became the psychologist that you are today. We talked about, you know, change in education, challenges of initiating change, tools for change at all these different levels. But I was wondering if you had any sort of conclusions or call to arms for the people who are listening, for somebody who is at a stage of their career where they've achieved a lot but are reflecting on that, you know, what would your conclusions about today's conversation or where we could be going next as a sort of next generation of psychologists?
I think we've kind of touched on that during this afternoon already, but it is being hopeful, it's being positive, it's being optimistic, and working with people to enable them to see that things can be different, things can be positive, things can be just that little bit better. It's what I was saying about asking teachers, you know, so when is Tim less bad? It's really quite powerful just to get them to kind of, you know, begin to see things different. And I think that the thread of what we've been talking about this afternoon is that positive vision of hope. And we have to maintain that. And I think we're so good at that. And I think it comes naturally to us as educational psychologists to you know, work with people, to work with systems, but above all else, to have that confidence in what we're doing and how we're working with people to try and effect change. I've got so much faith in our profession. I think we're brilliant. I think educational psychologists are fantastic, and I want everyone to know that. I think we can achieve so much. I mean, a call to arms, and these, you know, clearly there needs to be hordes of us educational psychologists out there bringing about positive change for society. I think that's where we should be.
Yeah, and I don't think I can necessarily add anything to that, because I totally agree. But thank you so much. It's been a really interesting and inspiring conversation. And one thing I've been reinvigorated with during this conversation of the importance of talking in a hopeful way to other psychologists who might not know, because it brings out those that sense of hope and that sense of agency that we can do something. So thank you so much for today, Gavin.
That's absolutely fine, Tim. Thank you for this opportunity, and continued good luck to you and everything that you're doing.
Thank you very much.